What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene between me and you on my rocking bicycle that's built for two. And you're listening to Out There here on Valley Free Radio. This show is originally being recorded. Oh no, the calendar is gone. Oh no, there it is. The show is originally being recorded on January 23rd, 2016. And today I'm live in the studio with two guests, Lois Ahrens, who is founder of the Real Cost of Prisons Project, and another local friend who's chosen to remain anonymous. So thank you both for coming in today. Lois, let's start with you. Can you just explain a little bit what the Real Cost of Prisons Project is?
Okay. The Real Cost of Prisons Project has a number of different parts. One part of it is work that focuses on the criminal legal system and how to change it in Massachusetts. All the different pieces of it, legislation and treatment of prisoners and fighting against new jails being built in Massachusetts. And I'd be happy to talk more about Massachusetts because after I say what the Real Cost of Prisons is, just because people have the wrong impression about Massachusetts. They think because it's a so-called progressive state that criminal justice policy in Massachusetts is progressive, and it is not. And so people need to know that in order to wake up enough to be concerned enough to start to change it. But if people think that everything's cool here, then they can go back to sleep.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my work, especially right at the moment, I mean, it goes and fits and starts depending on what's happening in the state, is focused on Massachusetts. And then the other part of my work is about what's happening around the country. And a big chunk of that is the incarceration of women, and how incarceration for women is different for men than for men. What drives women into prison is often different, and their treatment while they're incarcerated and then after incarceration. So that's another piece of what I do. And then the other part that I do nationally is a lot about sentences, what I call extreme sentences, which is a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, and the sentence of life with the possibility of parole, but often from parole boards that don't want to parole anybody. And so even though you have a sentence that says 25 years with the possibility of parole, this happens in Massachusetts a lot, you might not actually ever get paroled. So all of these I call extreme sentences, really, really long sentences where people are sentenced for their life or virtual life and end up dying in prison. And I do want to mention that the Real Cost Prisons Project has a Facebook page. And there are about 31,000 people that go to that page. So it's a busy, busy little page. And every day I post stuff on there. It's a public page. People can just like it. And about what's going on, not just in Massachusetts, but what's going on around the country in all of these different areas. And so I think people find it useful because it keeps getting bigger and bigger. I don't do anything to make it bigger. I just post these things on it. And there's also a website, which is therealcostofprisons.org. And two of the I think most important parts of the website is our categories called writing from prison, which is political writing from prisoners, and comics, political comics by prisoners. There are also on the website three of the comic books that I produced, and they're in a category called comic books. And there's a comic book on the war on drugs. There's a comic book on women and their children and incarceration. And there's a comic book on where prisons get built all around the country and what happens to the communities that they get built in and what happens to the communities where the people are sent from those mm-hmm. communities, the sending communities, like New York City, but people end up being incarcerated like near Buffalo.
Uh-huh.
You know, like 10, 12 hours away. I mean, like really, really far away from where people live. And it's a comic, it's called Prison Town, mm-hmm. that comic book. And so they're online. People can just go there and read them or download them or whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of different things. There are a lot of different pieces to what I do.
Yeah. We have the comic book, The Prisoners of the War on Drugs, at our house. And it's a very easy-to-read book and informative and artistically pleasing. So I encourage people to check out those comic books if they get a chance. So there's so many things from what you just said, so many directions we could take it in,
yes.
of course. Can you talk? So the Real Cost of Prisons project started around 2000, is that
yep.
right? So
yep.
how did you get into this?
I got into it kind of almost by mistake. I had always been an organizer, but I really, really didn't know much about prisons at all. And, I mean, the organizing that I had done in these big blocks of time was the women's movement and gay liberation, like way, way back, you know, like late 60s, 70s. And then for about 12 or 14 years, I did Central America organizing. And so I had a job, and the job was actually not programming, but fundraising and organizational development for this organization that did training for activists about the economy. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to figure out, they did these like economics camps every summer, they still do. And they were trying to figure out what else they could do other than just their regular, like, this is, you know, economics from a lefty point of view, you know, mm-hmm. like what else they could do. One year they had environmental justice. And I was just starting to read stuff about prisons, and I said, well, what about prisons? And they said, well, we don't know anything about that. And I said, well, yeah. I don't know that much about it either, but I bet I can find people to come and teach in this thing.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, back then, you could basically call up everybody that was doing this work around the country. I mean, it's really changed. Now there's uh-huh. so many more people. And so I just started making phone calls. I think it was like kind of even before like the internet that much. Uh-huh. You know, I just like call somebody and they'd say, oh, well, call so-and-so. And then I would call that person. Uh-huh. Anyway, so I ended up putting on this week-long event about prisons and the economy. And the people that I was bringing, everybody said, gee, it's too bad to do all this work and have it be like a one-shot deal, and uh-huh. then it's over. You know, why don't you see if you can get some money to actually build it into something else? And they introduced me to a funder, and I applied for, I was a grant writer. I mean, I still write grants, and I wrote a grant, and they funded it. And so I ended up leaving that job and starting the Real Cost of Prisons project. And one of the parts of the project were to bring people in who had been incarcerated who were organizers, and to bring people in to teach. A lot of times, let's say people that are working on issues like the war on drugs, they might not know anything about women in the war on drugs, or if they're working on trying to stop a prison, they don't know what's driving all these people into prisons. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know about the war on drugs. They know about how to stop a prison. And so this was an effort to get people together and learn about more content about each of their areas and then start talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, and then out of that, there was all of this material and information, and that's when I decided that I wanted to make these comic books. And so I did, and I ended up printing 135,000 of the comic books.
Wow. Just as time has gone on and more requests, orders have come in?
Well, I got money for a first thing, and then I had to hustle around and get more money for reprinting them. And eventually there were 135,000 that I printed.
And they were going out.
Yeah, they were all going out. In fact, they're all gone out. They're gone. <That's> many, great. Many, 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 many trips to the post office. I mean, like I knew every single person that worked at the post office.
Hopefully you weren't mailing them one at a time.
Sometimes I was mailing them one at a time. I was mailing them to people in prison. The majority of them, maybe 70,000, went to people that were in prison. Three at a time, you know, they would get a package of three and like a resource list. Wow. And so as soon as I started mailing them out, which was like 2005, I started getting back all of this mail from people that were locked up, you know. And so they started telling me what was going on. You know, I mean, I'd get every day. I mean, I'd open the mailbox, you know, and there would just be, I mean, I still get a ton of mail. Right. And because people, now it's changed some, but back then, the only way to communicate with somebody in prison was through mail. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, so I got my mailbox was like, I got more mail than probably, you know, like certainly anybody on my block. But like probably everybody on my block combined. And so, but I started learning all of this stuff from people, you know. I mean, like every day it would be I'd open a letter and I'd find out something else new. And a lot of what I found out was about extreme sentences. Uh-huh. And a lot of what I found out was about solitary and health care or lack of health care or, you know, horrible, horrible food or the treatment of prisoners by guards or cops or, you know, whoever was the people that were in control of them. And also the amazing work that prisoners were doing to push back. And so a number of people would write me and they would say, oh, I'm a writer. I'm doing this kind of writing or I'm a cartoonist. Do you want to see my cartoons? Do you want to see what I write? And I was like, yeah, send it to me. And so so that's when I started posting comics and writing from prisoners. It was all people that, you know, not everybody, but work that, you know, had content, like important political content.
Mm-hmm. So would you like take a screenshot and put it on your Facebook page? Or when you say post it, what do you mean?
I would bring it to Paradise Copies, which I still do, and they scan it and I post it on the web. The website. I don't personally post it, but maybe people know Winston Close. He
Winston,
posts it for me.
Okay.
And he's the person that's always done my website. And it's not a fancy website, but it's got a lot of stuff on it. Uh-huh. And so I send it to, I get it scanned, I send it to Winston, and it goes up there. And so I've been doing that for years and years and years. And over time, of course, a lot of the people that have been the writers and the cartoonists have become friends of mine. You know, I mean, some people over 15 years, 16 years now, you know, some people, I mean, we correspond, I don't know, you know, like maybe some people often over big, long periods of time. And some people, thankfully, are no longer incarcerated. Some of the people that, you know, friends of mine, they're people all over the country. They're not people here in Massachusetts necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, changed my whole life is different because, you know, than it was like almost 20 years ago. I mean, 20 years is a long time, but just because of, you know, the world that I'm in and the people that I know and what, you know, what I've learned and what I've tried to do to change the things that are, you know, that I want to change.
Yeah. You know, what I really like about that story is how, like, when you went into it, you said you didn't really have any knowledge or experience, but it didn't stop you. You found the people who did and went from there.
One thing that people always say to me is, they always say to me, well, do you have a loved one in prison? And because that's a lot of times how people get involved in doing prison work. You know, their son or husband or sister or whatever is in prison. And when I first started, the answer was no, you know. And now, of course, I mean, I have so many loved ones in prison and loved ones that have been in prison. You know, people that are, you know, really my close friends. You know, they are my loved ones, and there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
And one of them, who was somebody I was really, really close to, we met. He was like, somebody gave me his address when I first got the comic books, and I sent them to him. And he was in Pennsylvania. I sent him a set of comic books, and he wrote back, like, immediately, like, 2 days later. So then I got a letter from him. And we probably wrote pretty much, like, exchanged a letter pretty much every week for about maybe, well, since the comic books were printed, so 2005. And in June, he died.
In prison?
Yeah, he died in prison. He died, he was almost 86 years old.
Wow.
He had a life sentence in Pennsylvania. His name is Teo Atala Salah-El. And so, I mean, that, he's the second friend of mine that's died in prison. And so it's really, you know, when that happens, it's really, I mean, I tried to get his sentence commuted. And in Pennsylvania, they have this thing called compassionate release, but it's complete bull. You know, basically nobody gets let out on it. And we tried compassionate release, I did, and commutation, and couldn't get any of those things. And so he ended up dying there. And he's an amazing guy. Writer, a prison abolitionist who did prison abolition work for decades and decades before anybody even was really talking about it. He was a musician, sax player, and just an amazing guy, a writer. And a couple of months ago in October, after he died, I decided that all of his papers are at Special Collections at the University of Massachusetts. I had gotten them to take his papers, and I decided that we should have some kind of event celebration for Teo up, and we did it up at the Du Bois Center at UMass. And all of these people came that were connected to Teo that had written to him for, some of them for 40 years, came from all over the place. And we had this celebration of his life. We had a dinner, and it was really a great event. And now, so he was a jazz musician, jazz sax player, and a composer, and he composed all of these jazz songs. And so now I'm in the process of, I've raised some of it. I still have to raise a little bit more money to get a jazz group to a sax player and other people to record his music. And so I have almost all the money raised to do that. And I hope in the fall that we're going to, that those same people, that will have a concert in Northampton of Teo's music.
Oh, that's cool. So is this music that he wrote, like the sheet music for, but has it ever been played before?
No, he played it. There was a jazz combo that was in Dallas, was where the prison was, not Dallas, Texas, but this little weird dinky place out in the boondocks of Pennsylvania near Wilkes-Barre. It was called Dallas. And so he had this jazz combo, like back when that was more possible back then, like way back then.
You could have a musical instrument in jail.
Yeah. I mean, he always kept his sax until pretty recently. I mean, and then he finally sent it to somebody when he couldn't play anymore. But there was no, you know, no groups could get together and play the way they could. That was gone. I mean, all that's gone, you know. And yeah, exactly. I mean, all that is gone. Anyway, and so talking so much. And so he played there, and there was a newspaper article about him, you know, this concert that he gave. And I know he gave these concerts, but I've over the number of years, I've tried to get different sax players to play his music so I could hear it. I couldn't read it. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's just like, but there's like maybe 50 or 60 songs. And we know there were many, many more in the guards, like just, you know, would trash his cell and, you know, things were destroyed. I mean, over years. So this is just like a tip of the iceberg. But there's a great sax player. He teaches at UMass. His name is Felipe Salas. And I contacted him. And he teaches there, and he's like an internationally known sax player. And I met with him. I said, would you meet me to talk to me about this project? And so I met with him about 2 months ago or something. Uh-huh. And I told him the story of Tio, and I brought him the music. And he said, oh, I'm interested in doing this. And so, I mean, he's, you know, he'll get people together. I mean, he's, you know, like a key person in it. And he's, you know, a really great guy and a really well-known sax player. And so Tio, you know, I mean, there are parts of Tio's life, not just his writing, but his music and, you know, like his spirit. He had an amazing, amazing, amazing spirit. Yeah. And, you know, that will... They'll live on. Yeah. I mean, he was incarcerated for 50 years, you know. So, I mean, even though he was locked up for 50 years, he had this incredibly vibrant, productive life, despite everything that they did to try to, like, shut him down, which they did a lot to try to shut him down. And there's so many people I know like that, that are in prison, that are amazing people, that are doing amazing work. Amazing work, and despite everything that people do to them, the guards, the system, to try to prevent them from doing what they're doing. And if people go to the Real Cost Prisons website and you look at Writing from Inside and Comics from Inside, and you just look at, you know, like what people have to say. I mean, it's there's this one guy, his name is Gordon Haas, and he's in Massachusetts, he's a lifer. He's like the best researcher about the Department of Corrections in Massachusetts. And he knows how to file Freedom of Information requests like nobody, you know what I mean? He can get stuff, and he puts out these amazing reports that everybody uses, you know, and he's been locked up there basically forever. And but still, he manages to do this really incredible work, and I post his stuff on the website so that, and I also send it around to legislators and stuff like that so that people can see what's going on.
So you're listening to an interview with Lois Ahrens, founder of the Real Cost of Prisons Project and Northampton resident. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm going to play a little song. This is Billie Holiday. As soon as I get the computer together.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
So you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. My guests today are Lois Ahrens and a friend and neighbor from here in Florence. Lois is founder of the Real Cost of Prisons Project. And yeah, this is really cool to hear about T.O. and your friend and making the jazz musician. And then so you're getting this project together to have this music performed. That's awesome to hear about that relationship and how relationships change us.
Yeah, so. It was a very great relationship.
Yeah,
right. Well, I'm really compelled meeting this young lady, Miss Lowe's, and it's really emotional to hear about people that is incarcerated so long after they get a certain age.
Yeah,
and I think that there should be. Some committee, if they're geriatric, I think they should let those people out if they're not violent or a threat to our community. And unfortunately, I don't see that happen in a lot of cases around not just Massachusetts, but any other states that I'm aware of. But I think that would be it's sad that. To
it
see
is.
These people suffer mentally and physically.
I know.
And, I do a lot of reading about prisoners, or you could say inmates, but I like the word prisoner. So, and that are mentally challenged or are going through medical problems. They're not getting the right medical hospitalization, and they've been turned down.
Nobody does.
We have a high bill of medical. That's where all the money is going. Instead of letting these people, come to a part where they are getting the right caregiver, and they're not getting that. And you talked about my experience that I met people that. Have that is very talented in prison, and they can't get the message across. they've been incriminated or they've been falsely accused. That's really sad. You got people on drugs that they're not being rehabilitated.
No.
What do you think about being rehabilitated? Could I ask you that question?
I think it's a great idea. Yeah. It's too bad that all of these places that are called the, you know, Department of Corrections,
right,
you know, don't do anything about helping people correct their behavior and rehabilitate them. I mean, they're not, most prisons are not set up to,
right.
I mean, there's no, I mean, I'll tell you one fact. So the budget for the jails and prisons in Massachusetts is $1.2 billion. For the prisons, which is about 9,000 people, which is compared to other states, I mean, right. There are not that many people in Massachusetts, but so let's say there are 9,000 people that are locked up in prisons, not in jails. And so it's more than $500 million goes to pay for locking up those 9,000 people. Of that $500 million, 1.9%, not even 2%, mm-hmm. goes to all programs, any kind of rehabilitative programs, any kind of education programs, less than 2% of $500 million. So to me, when I look at that number and I think, okay, this shows where their priority is. It's like at the bottom of the bottom of the bottom of the heap. Right. 2%, not even, for everything. So how in the world is anybody sitting there year in, year out, even if they're in for a couple of years in prison?
Right.
You know, what is it that's there for them to actually get people to move from the place that got them there?
Right. Right.
To the place that hopefully they're going to want to be when they get out. Right. Nothing. Nothing.
I agree. What do you think about enterprising prisoners? There's enterprises inside prison that they work for a dollar. Some work for 50 cents.
Try 10 cents.
10 cents. So they call it industrial enterprises.
Right.
But if you got industrial enterprises, then upon their release, there should be a program set up for these people that are unemployed. They don't have nowhere to go. They have no family, no friends. What is your theory about that?
So to me, I think, you know, it's good. People end up working in prison for basically, some people, 10 cents, 15 cents, right, an hour. Mm-hmm. And people want to do it because they want the 10 or 15 cents because they have to pay for commissary, exactly. or whatever right. it is, right. both, you know, mm-hmm. that they have to pay for these exorbitant prices to right. buy the most tiny things, right?
It's out ridiculous.
Of completely ripping everybody off, completely. Yeah. And they make this tiny amount of money and then they get ripped off to buy, you know, a package of dry soup or something. And so, so I'm not against people working in prison.
Right.
But I think if they work, they should be paid a decent amount. There's a bill, I'm sure it's not going to pass, but there's this moment right now in the state of Massachusetts when all the bills start in the new year, like everybody starts filing bills mm-hmm. for the legislative session that lasts 2 years.
Right.
And there's a bill that says that people should get paid a minimum wage of a dollar
right.
an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, there's probably, I mean, maybe the only place where people get paid that big an amount of money is in UNICOR, the federal prison. Federal prison system.
Yeah.
And if you're a high up worker in that system, maybe you'd be making a dollar an hour or maybe you'd be making a dollar and a quarter. I mean, that's like the top. But
right.
there's no state where that's true. I mean, even these people that are out on the fire lines fighting fires
right.
in California.
If I'm not mistaken, I think federal prison, they do pay them a large amount of money.
No, I'm
they
telling
don't.
You
well,
it
was
what
like
it
a
is.
Dollar. When I was
oh,
in,
really?
It was a dollar something.
I was told that
yeah,
they,
dollar.
It depends on their enterprise, though. I don't know how true that is. Okay.
No, it's no. not. Mm-hmm. I mean, UNICOR, that's the big
right,
company
right.
of the federal prison system.
Right.
And there are other companies that are that are private companies
right.
that have federal prisoners working for them in
I have,
there.
I don't mean to shift this subject,
no.
but I have a concern about getting write-ups in prison. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
They penalize these people. They take their money. If they're making a dollar, then they have to pay back for a write-up. And they're making millions and millions of dollars instead of putting this money. Where's this money being allocated?
I have a friend who's in North Carolina, locked up. He's a cartoonist. His name is Willie Worley. His cartoons are on the website.
Right.
And so if I send him money, because he's got these write-ups, if I send him money, which I don't anymore, they take the money.
Yeah, it's going to be zapped.
Yeah, they're going to take most of that money and put it in for these whatever they call demerits, whatever
right.
And so it's not. So now, if I want to send him something, so I don't send him money. What I send him is, you know, a box of
You can get a box. You can get a box. They call it package box. You can get that.
Exactly.
Yeah. You order it through commissary.
Right, commissary.
Order it through a company, and it's completely, it's the worst crap food that you could possibly
and overpriced.
Imagine. Right. I mean, you can't even imagine how bad it is. You know, like just garbage food, absolute garbage food. I mean, if you can look down and you try to find one thing that is even not completely processed, and it's incredibly expensive.
Right.
So, like, a little box of garbage is like $30, and then you have to pay $5 to send. And so I don't send him money, but he can trade.
He doesn't want
this crap.
Right.
He can he can trade it for something else, so it becomes money.
But I don't
send them money because they're going to take it.
They're going to take it, and it's ridiculous.
I mean, that's North Carolina.
Nobody.
I mean, that is a peculiar thing to North Carolina.
It's the same thing with the telecom communication.
Oh, yeah.
They're making billions of dollars off a phone call. Mm. These people sitting there, they want to hear it from their family. Right. These people are in poverty, mostly African Americans. Let me just be honest with you. They're sending their whole check, and they, you know, these people want to hear their family. They're dying mentally and physically, and it's sad. And they got to work hard to interact with their family that is incarcerated.
Absolutely,
their daughters, their sons want to hear
and
their voice.
And who ends up paying for it? It's the families that are poorer to begin with.
Yeah,
if the families weren't poor, there's a good possibility that their relatives wouldn't be locked up.
They would have been able to hire a lawyer and all that.
Right.
So.
They'd have a lawyer. Wow. They wouldn't be locked up. You know, I mean, on and on and on. But so it's the families that are start out being poor and then get further impoverished by telephones. I mean, the ripoffs of the telephone. I mean, the jail here is a ripoff telephone thing.
Do you know how much it costs, for example, to make a phone call?
I can't remember what it is, but it's. The jails in Massachusetts are making more money off telephone calls. I can't remember what the number is. The jails are, each sheriff makes their own contract with a telephone company, Securus, whichever one they use, and so they get these big kickbacks from that. And each sheriff makes their own deal. And so they get as much as they can get. And who pays? The family members pay.
If I'm not mistaken, I read the warden get also a bonus out of that, believe it or not, in some cases. I don't know how true it is.
I don't know. I don't know how that goes here.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know if the sheriff actually gets a personal kickback. I don't think so. But, I mean, I hope not. I mean, I've never heard that happen.
In the Department of Correction.
Yeah, Department of Correction.
Correction.
Yeah.
Not in the jail, but Department of Correction.
Yeah. I mean, in the Department of Correction in Massachusetts, that's negotiated. All the prisons are negotiated as one package, you know.
Mm-hmm. For listeners, let's just clarify. Like, there's, like, county jail, and there's Department of Corrections, which is a state system, and then there's the federal system.
Exactly. Okay, exactly. Exactly. And here in Massachusetts, every sheriff, every county has a jail, and every sheriff is the king of his own castle. And they can do basically what they want to do.
Mm-hmm. They can dictate whatever. They can make any rules they want.
It's true. So, I mean, there's almost no overarching supervision. There was a law that passed called the Criminal Justice Reform Act. It passed in April of last year. And that, in that bill, we'll see what actually happens. I mean, that law, it's now an act, it's a law now. Mm-hmm. There are all of these different pieces in the law that says for the first time that sheriffs are going to actually have to report something about who's locked up, how many people are locked up, who they are, programs, all of these things that they've never, ever, ever had to report to anyone. And so we'll see, theoretically, if they, I mean, it's a law. We'll see if there's a thing called the Executive Office of Public Safety and Security, EOPS. Mm-hmm. It's the overarching thing over the Department of Correction and the sheriffs. So theoretically, they're going to have to report some of this information to EOPS. And then it will be possible to compare what one jail is doing, what another jail is doing, and compare them in the state. But before that, there's never been any way, I mean, till to now, I mean, there's never been any way to look at one and see one's doing a better program, one's worse, one's terrible. There's a guy out in Bristol County named Hodgson who's like a Arpaio wannabe, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a really, really, really bad guy. And, you know, what he's doing, I mean, he has like the highest suicide rate. But, you know, nobody's on him. Nobody is on him. And so hopefully if this actually goes into effect and they do start asking sheriffs for some of this information, it'll be able to compare what these different sheriffs are doing. But before that, there's not been anything. So they're all just doing basically what they, you know, what they want to do. If they want to do something good, great. Mm-hmm. If they don't, they don't.
Well, you're listening to an interview with Lois Ahrens, the founder of the Real Cost of Prisons Project, and another friend and neighbor from Florence. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio, and I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. So I wanted to ask you all just briefly about the terminology, like talking about people as inmates versus prisoners or, you know, incarcerated people. How does that affect people psychologically?
So there are a whole bunch of us. I've never been incarcerated, but most of the people I work with around the country have been. And those people started a campaign basically to ditch the word inmate. They were called inmates constantly, sometimes people of 20 years, inmate this, inmate that. And when they got out, and it was a word that the, you know, jail or prison really always used to denigrate people and to make them, you know, to not treat them as human beings, an inmate. And so so the last few years, we've been working on trying to get people to not use that word and to use the word incarcerated person, a person, not an inmate, like an incarcerated person, a human being, a formerly incarcerated person, someone who has been locked up, to not use the word offender, but somebody, a person who committed an offense. Mm-hmm. So that the whole totality of that person is not the offender. The whole totality of that person is not a felon or an ex-felon, but someone who committed a felony, one thing or two things or whatever the thing is. But they basically, with this idea that whoever committed a felony, whoever committed an offense, is more than that thing. They are not an offender. They are not a convict, ex-convict. Yeah. And so So that's our campaign and or a campaign, and it's a campaign of language. And one of the other parts of the language that I also am trying to get people to do is stop calling jails and prisons facilities. Because to me, I mean, like my gym is called a facility. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like where if you go to like an industrial laundromat, it's a facility. You know, everything is a facility now. And so by calling a jail and a prison a facility, it takes away from what it is. It's not a facility.
Excuse me.
Jail.
But what about institutional? That's been used.
An institution.
Right,
yeah.
It is an institution.
Right. I mean, a lot of them are called like the, you know, something institution. That's something that they're calling themselves. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times when people, like in the paper, you'll start seeing it, you know, like this facility, that facility, where people are referring to it as a facility. Well, I'm saying people should, if it's a jail, call it a jail.
Right. What about the Hampshire County House of Corrections?
It's a house. Well, I mean, this whole thing about a House of Corrections and a jail, I mean, this is a peculiar, House of Corrections, and this is odd, I mean, there's so many weird quirks about Massachusetts, but House of Corrections in the language of, you know, like the institutional language, House of Corrections, is a place where people who have been sentenced are incarcerated. And people who haven't been sentenced, even though it's physically the same place, uh-huh. people that are there pretrial, people that are being held on because they can't make bail, they are being held in the jail.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a lot of these words get used, you know, but yeah. but a House of Corrections, this is, you know, the nomenclature or whatever of, yeah. of Massachusetts. Yeah. You know, if you're sentenced and you're there for, you know, up to 2.5 years and you're a sentenced prisoner and you're in the House of Corrections. If you're there, we didn't even talk about bail, but if
yeah,
you're
I
there,
talk about that a little bit.
If you're there because you can't make bail, you're there pretrial, you're in, quote, jail. You're in the same physical space as the House of Corrections and the jail. But yeah. it's just the language of yeah. the jails in Massachusetts. Yeah.
So, yes, I kind of wanted to talk maybe a little bit about overcrowding and bail and how that's related. So I have friends who aren't really familiar with jails and or even what bail is.
Yes.
Can you, either of you, do you want to explain bail and how that affects people disproportionately?
Yeah, bail is, the purpose of bail is to assign a monetary thing so that you show back up. And if you can't make bail, then if you can't make whatever the number is, 500, 1,000, 2,000, then you get locked up. So what it means is that people that can't make bail because they're poor, they end up getting locked up because they don't have the money to put the money up and then, you know, put the money up in their place. And so what those of us that are working, there are people all around the country that are working to try to end money bail. And we almost got that passed a couple of years ago mm-hmm. in Massachusetts. We didn't succeed. At the Hampshire County Jail, more than 50% of the people up there are there because they can't make bail.
Oh, they haven't been convicted of any crime.
They have not been convicted of any crime. And that's true about every jail in the country. More than 50% of the people in jails are there because they are too poor to make bail. And so what we're saying is that can't be, that then it, in jail becomes a debtor's prison. It shouldn't be whether you're locked up or not locked up, whether you have access to $500 or not.
Mm-hmm.
It should be, you should be let out on personal recognizance. Right. You could check in some places, like they, instead of having people locked up, they call in on the phone once a week.
Uh-huh. Because if your bail is that low, like your bail is set based on how risky the judge thinks you are, how much of a risk to society.
Theoretically,
right? So if your bail is that low, you know, if your bail is like $500, $1,000,
right.
that's like you're not considered a risk.
But the thing
right?
is that if they think that somebody's a risk, there's a thing called a dangerousness hearing. Mm. So if they think if somebody is really dangerous, they have to have a separate procedural hearing that says, in front of a judge that says this, where the person has to, the DA has to show that this person is too dangerous to be let out.
Right.
So it's not based on whether they have money or not money. It's based on if there actually is a reason to hold somebody. And in states like New Jersey got rid of bail. And so D.C. doesn't have bail. And so 80-something percent of people get released, and the other 10% or 12% or whatever it is, and let's say in D.C., that get held are getting held because the district attorney has demonstrated that that person should not be let out, not mm-hmm. because they don't have money, but mm-hmm. because there's a reason for them to be held, mm-hmm. and that reason yeah. is that they're dangerous to somebody,
yeah.
and so to somebody else, and so... That's a system that we're trying to move to in Massachusetts. Right now, a couple of year or so ago, there was a ruling in front of the Supreme Judicial Court called Brangan, B-R-A-N-G-A-N. And they basically said that this was a SJC Supreme Judicial Court ruling that said you cannot hold the judge has to ask the find out if that person can make bail. And they can't hold them just because they can't make bail. And so that now is a legal ruling, and it was in the same language was put in this Criminal Justice Reform Act that I just said passed in April. But now what's happened is, even though it's a law, even though it was a Supreme Judicial Court ruling, mm-hmm. right, you'd think, okay, everybody's doing it. The DAs aren't following it. Even criminal defense lawyers aren't saying, oh, you know, you need to let my client go because he can't or she can't just stay because she can't make money. And the judges, it's not being enforced. And so one of the new pieces of legislation that's just been introduced by our very own Lindsay Sabdosa, our new state rep, is to start if it passes, would be a law, an act that would try to track how these different courts are actually enforcing the Brangan decision or not. Mm-hmm. Because if it was starting to be enforced, the jail could be half empty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The jail could be half empty. And so these people that want to build new jails, they don't have any reason to be building these new jails yeah. because they would be emptied out if it was just a question of people's money or not about mm-hmm. money. And so we'll see. I mean, this is a new thing in Massachusetts about bail and who can be held and who can't and for what reason. Uh-huh. And hopefully Lindsay's law will be passed and we'll at least start tracking. Right now, nobody knows who's doing it. The only places that they know, some places that in Suffolk County, there are literally court watch people. There are people sitting in the court seeing what happens to some of, like, is anybody enforcing the Brangan decision? Mm-hmm. And they're finding out that mostly it's not. There's no training. There's no anything. And so that's the reason. So it's potentially a really, really, really powerful yeah. thing. In terms of bail and in terms of jails being, people being locked up who haven't been convicted of anything.
Yeah, I mean, we've only talked a little bit about, you know, people not being able to afford it and the economics or whatever, but we haven't even touched on the racial dynamics of who's
right.
in
we
there
have,
and who's accused
have,
without being convicted
have,
or whatever.
We so. Haven't. I mean, it's yeah. a lot. I mean, it's, of course, about race and racism, but it's also a lot about poverty and access to money and access to, because of racism, you know, people who's got more access to money. I mean, there have been all of these studies that, I mean, they're saying it now with these, you know, with the government shutdown, that most people, even government employees that have full-time jobs, don't have $400 in cash that they can, these people
afford.
With jobs
yeah.
and regular government jobs. And so, I mean, when you hear this number, 400, and you think $400, and then people that have regular full-time jobs, they don't have that resource of that amount of money, then you think, how the hell is anybody going to bail out a family member
yeah, right.
for $400 or $500?
Right. Yeah. Okay,
well, no, it's. I mean, I agree. I mean, it's poverty, social economics, racism. I mean, not only racism could be any one Caucasian that is in poverty, that they can't make a bail. Mm-hmm. But you did, on the subject of bailing out, I mean, there's limitation on certain crimes that you, I do agree with, like violent crime, domestic violence. I think that that needs to be looked into before I let this person out. You know,
that's
we need
what
to put
a dangerousness hearing is
right,
for.
Right, right.
That's, it's some process to actually see if this person is let out, what are the consequences of that? So it's not based on their, because a lot of times you could be the worst person imaginable and you have the $100,000 or the $200,000 to bail yourself out, or your daddy can bail you out.
That,
I mean, this did happen in Massachusetts. Yeah. And then this, you know, really wealthy guy, father with really this kid that was doing really, really, and he kept being bailed out by his father. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, the last time that he was bailed out for like $100,000 or $150,000, he went and he killed his ex-girlfend because the father just kept bailing him out. But there was no process where they didn't use that process. Instead, it was all about money.
Well, it's about money. I mean, it's just like if an African-American, he kills someone, it's African-American, black-on-black crime. You know, it's an epidemic, unfortunately. But versus a small story, let me make it quick. This white gentleman, he was a student, and he killed another student. His father was a multimillionaire. This lawyer that was don't get out of his bed unless it's $100,000 or $200,000 better. He's not going to move. His father called the lawyer and he said, "Look, I got $200,000 for you to get my son out." He got up and he got him out. Mm-hmm. But if it was someone else,
of course,
he would have never got him out.
No,
So we're gonna have to wrap it up.
That cheery note.
I'm just gonna, on the cheery note, I just want to review a couple things, promising things that you said, Lois, about the legal things going on in Massachusetts that offer some hope. Lindsay Sabadosa's introducing this bill about bail. So I just want to thank both of you for coming in. I've been talking with Lois Ahrens, founder of the Real Cost of Prisons Project, a Northampton resident, also my friend here from Florence. And you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock.